This is Kat O'Connor of Burning Bridged Media. You're listening to the Audio Drama Production Podcast.
Hello, welcome once again to the Audio Drama Production Podcast. My name is Roberts, and along with my old chum Matthew, we aim to bring you a weekly dose of audio drama goodness from behind the scenes. We're talking hints, tips, discussions, and interviews with the experts. Oh, and our online home is at www.audiodramaproduction.com. And talking of interviews with experts, Mr. Matthews sat down recently with Sibby Wieland of Soundstages Radio. Sibby was instrumental in bringing about the Audio Drama Day in the US, and she recently organised an audio drama panel at the South by Southwest Film Festival. On top of that, she's worked tirelessly to raise the profile of audio drama across the world. Sounds like the sort of person we should all get to know. And Matthew did just that.
So on the show this week, we have an absolute encyclopedia of audio drama. Sibby Wieland, welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast.
Thank you.
I say that because I was reading the notes leading up to the interview. You sent me some notes over because I'd requested some, and wow. I read that you've done a master's thesis on audio drama and podcasts, and that caught my eye straight away. Was that part of your master's?
It was part of the thesis. Since I studied instructional design and technology, I had to change it eventually if I wanted to graduate. So I wanted to study what's called entertainment education, which is a type of audio drama. If you are you familiar with Tony Palermo and his work? He's worked for the World Health Organization, and he's gone to sub-Saharan Africa, and he'll help them write a radio show that teaches people better hygiene or how to protect against HIV. So, you know, that's really exciting way that audio drama is being used, but there's not a lot out there in the literature. So I moved to more straightforward, let's see how well people remember information they learn, whether they learn it from an audio podcast versus reading it or seeing it written up on a screen. How well do they remember that? So
that's really interesting. I could relate to that. I mean, I didn't do a master's. I'm not that advanced, but I did my honours degree just very recently and wrote my dissertation on recording methods in audio drama. And aside from, I had Richard Hand's book, a former guest on the show. He's a lecturer down in Wales. I had the book by Tim Crook, which is good, but I guess getting a wee bit dated. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. It's called Radio Drama.
That is one of those books I haven't been able to get in this country. Some of the ones that have been published in England, you know, what I can get is access by looking in Google Books and seeing if there's a preview. What I have been able to get a hold of is the odd book on radio or on theater where there may be a section describing audio theater, and it will really be like just a couple of paragraphs. And there's a lot of stuff that came out in the 1940s and 50s in the United States that's, you know, audio plays that the idea was a student radio station or a English class was going to produce it. So there used to be a lot of scholarship on this, and now there's nothing. And it's really this community that's keeping it alive in North America. It's like the secret that, you know, if you just can get in there and learn about audio drama, you discover just how many people are doing it. It's really incredible, but it's not being borne out in this country, and I can't speak for Canada. Although I know that Jack Ward has published some of his plays, and they're ideal for educating students and having them learn how to do radio drama in the classroom. But there's really not a lot, and there's not a lot on podcasting in the literature either, and that really amazed me. Most of the articles are here's how you can do a podcast and you can use it in your classroom. And there's very little about why you would use beyond the fact that it's new and it's cool. It isn't really about podcasting being a tool to use in this situation versus another. And I think that's why podcasting doesn't have as high a profile as it could.
Do you think there's a big gap in the market for some sort of academic style textbook in the world of podcasting and audio drama now? And could you write it?
I would. I mean, I think what would be really exciting is to have more of an anthology which could talk about the different ways that you could approach audio drama, you know, from the standpoint of entertainment education. You know, what's exciting about the work that's being done in the developing world is that, you know, if you're in a very rural area, your local radio station is your lifeline to everything. And that's still true in a lot of places in the United States and Canada. And that was one of the things that built into War of the Worlds, Houston, that script that I wrote, because I saw that radio can still be powerful in that way. And you can take audio drama as a tool to really build in your community new knowledge or practice. But at the same time, it can be used in so many other ways. You know, you've had other guests talk about, you know, it can help students learn English and, you know, just discover their limits and what they can do. So it would be really interesting to pull more of an anthology, because we're such a decentralized community, and what somebody is doing in New York State and what somebody's doing in Florida and Oregon, there's no one best practice that one group has over another. There's lots of best practices that meet the needs of each community, if that makes sense.
Just on the subject as well, like, we were talking with Matthew and Monique at Oral Stage recently, and they had said, because they're in production of their new show Otherworldlies at the moment, and they'd commented that someone had asked them, I think it was in the building they were in, you know, what are you doing? And you'll know yourself, if you've ever had to quickly explain, oh, we're recording an audio drama, it's not enough to say that, because somebody's like, what's an audio drama? Is that like an audio book? You know, and you go down this rabbit hole. And, you know, we mentioned before we started recording an elevator pitch. Do we need the elevator pitch, or is that just a bit too glib? Would it do us a misservice almost to try and condense it down into something like that?
I really think that an elevator pitch or an elevator speech, I do think that it helps, because what's happening is, whether audio drama creators and fans like it or not, there is an elevator pitch out there, and it's old time radio. So, you know, there's a bit of a vacuum. And if you say, well, you know, it's storytelling through audio with sound effects and actors, and people say, oh, old time radio, where people get dressed up on stage and, you know, and you know, they do all the weird stuff on that table, right? Oh, I love those. That's so cool. And that's been my experience, is, you know, people generally think of audio drama as being OTR. And I think modern audio drama is so different. It's so much more intimate. There's a lot more science fiction and fantasy being produced in modern audio drama. And I think the sensibility is different. It's more experimental. It's not necessarily as pat as some of the work that was, it was terrific and it was very solid, but, you know, at the end of a half hour episode, even the really good ones, like Nightbeat was one of my favorites from the late 50s. But, you know, at the end of the episode, you know, there was the tagline and the good guy, you know, puts on his hat and walks away. I mean, and modern audio drama is a lot more sophisticated and mature, frankly. So I think we kind of have to sell the sizzle a little bit with audio drama. And I think that one thing I really worry about is if people think that the audio drama right in front of them is the only one that exists, then it continues to be seen as more of a novelty. And if you have a very localized, very regional audio drama troupe that goes away, there may or may not be another group that comes up and takes their place. And if nobody's writing about audio drama in the context of a community, people forget. And then they go back to the idea again. Oh, old time radio, right? It's kind of dressing up in costume and doing sound effects, you know, with a box of mashed potatoes, right? That's audio drama. So
it kind of comes back to what we say recently on the podcast as well about being found online. And we've started encouraging people to actually put the words audio and drama in their titles because, you know, iTunes should be treated as a search engine. And I remember back when, you know, we've not been in audio drama that long at all, only about 4 or 5 years now. And when we discovered We're Alive, I think I went on to iTunes and typed in audio drama because I wanted more. I just wanted to find more content. And I really didn't find all that much stuff because probably a lot of the shows just didn't have the word audio drama or the words audio drama in their titles. And therefore, the only way for me to find these shows was then to go into the community and slowly get to know people and eventually get round to discovering shows. And there are shows that I've discovered, you know, months, just a couple of months ago, which have been out for years. And I'm listening to them thinking, this is excellent. Where has this been? You know, why couldn't I find this show? So it's that discoverability thing, isn't it? I mean, it just comes down to the fact that, you know, iTunes won't give us that audio drama category at the moment. We probably won't get one on Audible. And it's, you know, we're kind of lumped in with podcasting. And it's a lack of identity, isn't it?
Yeah. And the funny thing, too, about it is that there's, I've had the same experience, and it's embarrassing, you know. Oh, this, you know, how did I not know that this was being produced? And it's fantastic. You know, there's a very solid, radio theater up in Dallas, and I didn't know about it for several years because I didn't know how to find it. Rich Froelich doing wonderful, very solid stuff. So I think a lot of people have had that experience, but I think the discoverability, it has to work in two levels. Cause on the one hand, if you know what audio drama is, you want more of it. And you, hopefully have fallen in love with the medium and you want to, download or stream more material. But I think also a creator has to, not everything has to be high concept, in the sense that the story itself will excite people so much that they have to tune in, they have to find this. But I think that if you are if you're thinking about how to market your work in a way that people outside of audio drama will just come to it for the content, it is very valuable. So, for example, we had people come to our live show that we did twice in 2013 because they were interested in veterans and veterans history. And we tied it into the Gettysburg 150th anniversary and also into Veterans Day and other work that we were doing for veterans. And so we had this built-in audience. They didn't really care whether it was audio drama or not. They wanted to know what we had to say about those issues. And, you know, at the end, you know, that was our opportunity to talk about, hey, you know, this is a thing, audio drama, you know, and we're going to perform at a later date and you can come back and see us do War of the Worlds. And so we got some people coming back after that, but they came because they were interested in the subject matter or in some cases, I mean, with We Are Alive, for instance, that story is so it's so exciting. I don't even talk to people when I tell them about that show. I just say, well, you like zombies? Have you heard this podcast? You know, and that's what gets them there.
And do you think that falls on the shoulders of individual creators or producers, that it's maybe not about trying to get people necessarily to listen to your show? It's just getting them to listen to audio drama and try and hook them into the medium.
Well, in an ideal world, yes. I think that, I mean, this is a fantastic service that your podcast has been doing, because it's not only a place where people are talking about doing better practice and really thinking about these things, but really talking about, hey, are we in a situation where we can help one another and we can grow the community and the audience as a whole. And I think in the past, I like the way that J. Michael Straczynski, he has a fantastic book about screenwriting, which has sections about audio drama and about writing for animation, you know, writing the voiceover sections. And he talks about the Golden Age and the Silver Age. And I think with the Silver Age, I mean, the Golden Age, it was all around you. Everybody listened to the radio. With the Silver Age, I think you had a really, really strong community of people focused around things like the Midwest Radio Workshop. And you had public radio in the United States, especially, as well as in Canada with the CBC, really pushing this idea, this identity of audio drama. And, you know, you turned on the radio because you were interested in being transported somewhere, maybe to a talk show, maybe to a mystery. And we don't have that right now because we're so decentralized. But what we can have is methods of really assisting one another and, you know, promoting other works. I mean, if I really fall in love with something, I try to get my friends, and not just people who listen to audio drama that I know in the community, but, you know, my friends who love science fiction or they love old movies, you know, so you got to listen to this because you'll just, you know, Mask of Inanna, you know, you'll love this, you know, just give it a chance. Here, I'll put it on a CD for you and you can listen it in the car, you know, so that helps. That really helps.
What about audio drama day? How's sort of that been going, and has it managed to have its desired impact, do you think, so far?
I think we've grown it. It's been something where I think we still have room to grow with audio drama day. You know, we were actually looking into whether we could get a state proclamation starting in Florida. Because one of my partners in Soundstages Radio is based out of Tallahassee, the state capital. And, you know, there was a lot of interest, but it is a multi-step process to get something, you know, very formal like that. And before we knew it, it really took off on Facebook. And I think we have well over 300 people who are on the page in the last couple of months. And I think we'll know better by September if we're going to reach a lot more people. So what I want to have is, I want to have a lot of things listed that are local and regional, anything that is going on live radio or in the theater. I want to make sure that there is that place, because normally, you know, maybe people would not have the chance to know about something local happening unless they just happen to be on a list, like the Modern Audio Drama mailing list, or one of the many communities on Facebook where people are saying, you know, I'm doing this and I'd like some advice. I like the idea that we're growing something that's grassroots, and that, you know, the next time that I reach out to the media with a press release, that we're going to have a number of different shows, because there's so much already happening in the United States and Canada around Halloween. And I know it's a, I don't, I don't know exactly what it's like in Scotland or in the UK. I mean, I always think of that Fry and Laurie routine about Halloween. So I don't know if there's a lot going on Halloween, but there is over here. It's a great time for spooky stories. And I'd love if that could be more of a time that it's promoted as an art form.
We'll talk about live shows and things like that in a second, but for anyone listening who's maybe, you know, a creator of audio drama or an enthusiast, and they're maybe living in a bit of isolation in a place where it's very unlikely that, you know, any event's going to take place, what can someone in that situation do in the lead up to Audio Drama Day that might, you know, make them feel like they are involved in it as well?
Well, I think the one benefit of being somewhere so rural and isolated, where it's just not taken hold for whatever reason, is that you have a lot more leeway with your local government and officials. I mean, if you want to look at what can be done in a very small town, all you have to do is look at Icebox Radio Theater. And that community of International Falls has really just embraced all of the work that Jeff Adams has done. You know, there's live performances that are done on the stage and also broadcast. So if a person is just really interested in audio drama and there's a local radio station, maybe they can approach them and see about doing a short reading. I mean, nobody says the first time you do an audio drama that it has to be half an hour. Nobody says it can't be, you know, 5 minutes. And maybe approach the local media, maybe do a staged reading in your local theater. You know, nobody says that you need to have a full Foley table to do a live performance. I mean, our first live performance, we had Tex running the sound from a sound booth. And I don't think it took away from anybody's enjoyment one bit. I mean, it's exciting to have a Foley table, but you don't need it. So I think that a person in a small town can certainly reach the media in their town and be more likely to just, you know, like the old Judy Garland movies, you know, gang, let's put on a show. And I think here in Houston, for example, you know, we're thinking about, well, where can we go? And where is there an audience? And, you know, are we going to charge people? And, you know, and you don't necessarily have to worry about that in a small town for Audio Drama Day.
You've got a lot of experience, obviously, putting on live shows. You know, what's it like? I don't know a lot about live shows myself. You know, what's involved in it, and how do you sort of execute it, and what response do you get?
Well, it's something that, I mean, I had done children's theater when I was a kid, and then I hadn't done anything in theater for years and years and years and years. And I studied film, and when I worked as a professional, I was working in a studio. You know, I would just record what I needed, and then I'd go and edit it. And working and doing live audio theater, whether or not you're doing it just as a one shot, or whether you're planning to take the recording and make it available for an audience, is very different. And if you're lucky, and I was extremely lucky, you'll find somebody who is as passionate about audio drama in all its forms as they are about theater, who's willing to work with you and show you the ropes. And I had that. The director that I worked with multiple times is Dr. David Lemaster, he's an English professor here in Houston, but he's been working in theater for many decades. And, you know, we had previously discovered that we loved, you know, silent films, and he loves Jack Benny. And still, there was a lot that we had to learn from one another. And I would say that if you go to the theater before you even consider putting on a show, and really take a look at all of the elements that go into making that stage play, the lighting, the sound design, and the actors, and even the shape of the theater. You know, are you going to be working in a black box theater? Are you going to be working in a proscenium? And, you know, are you able to get a sense of the energy from the actors as you're working? And so, like it or not, these were all kinds of things that I had to take into consideration as I took my scripts and got them ready to go. So one thing that I had to learn, for instance, was how to run a tech rehearsal. So I wasn't the director, I was the producer. So I wrote, and then the director and I worked with techs to do, well, if you're lucky, and this happens more often at the college level, you do something called a paper tech. And you sit down with the sound designer and the director, and hopefully you have a stage manager, and you figure out where all these cues are. And it doesn't matter whether these are organic sound effects that a Foley artist is going to do on the stage, or whether it's going to be triggered from the sound booth. You figure out what you want that to sound like, what kind of body or quality you want to have to that sound. You figure out the lighting, and you really break it out all over that script. And all you're doing is just talking. So you go from there through a dry tech where you just do a cue to cue, and you trigger all of those cues. And I'd never done anything like that before. And, you know, and if you're doing an audio drama, it's absolutely crucial that those cues go off. And you learn real quick that if you don't have it together, you know, it's going to be a problem for the audience. And finally, you do another rehearsal where you're running through this, both the live sound and with the actors. And it's a completely different way than most audio dramatists. And I think also most people who write audio drama, how they think about sound. Because I know that when I have edited work as a professional, if I'm doing a video, for instance, and I'm going back and I need to add sound effects, or if I'm doing a voiceover recording that I'm turning into an ad or something, you know, I record the actor first, and then I put in the sound and I try to make it sound organic. Here, you got to do it the other way around. You got to make sure that the sound works well, and then you have to have the actor in that later rehearsal react to it, because the audience is going to see how they react to it. So it's very challenging, but it's exciting, because you get that immediate response from the audience. But when you listen again later on, my experience was that things that worked really well as live sound effects for an audience watching, when we would hear it later, would say, oh no, the audience listening, you know, on their iPod, they're not going to know what that is. They're not going to know. If you have Foley artists making a sound effect, your audience may be very excited by what they're seeing. For example, we had people making I think that they were stomping on something to make a gunshot, and that's not going to fly. It's not going to fly later on when you hear it in playback. And that was an experience. I mean, we made mistakes, but it's very exciting. You get that immediate feedback, which, especially if you have a podcast, you know, you send it out in the world and you hope somebody will find it, and maybe you hear back, you know, right away, and maybe somebody discovers you, like we were talking about, a couple of years later, you know. But in live theater, you get that response right away.
In real life, it's just the one-star review on iTunes. This was the worst thing I've ever heard, and you can't reply to them. Well, that's interesting about the Foley artist. Do the audience, can the audience actually see the Foley person like doing all their stuff then?
Yeah, and that was when I was very lucky. I was able to attend National Audio Theater Festivals in 2009, and Tony Brewer, out of Bloomington, Indiana, fantastic Foley artist, also a poet, and got to watch him do his magic. I mean, you know, he's mesmerizing. And so we were looking to do the same thing with our Foley artists on the stage. If you go to Dragon Con, for example, in Labor Day weekend in Atlanta, Atlanta Radio Theater has two just absolutely packed performances, and they always have the Foley artists really in the middle of the stage, and people are really fascinated by what they're doing. Now, for me personally, I don't want to watch them. I would prefer to close my eyes, and you'll see people in the audience, they'll have their eyes closed, and they don't want to break the spell. But other people are really excited. They, you know, if you're doing children's theater, for example, you could even add, you know, a little mini clinic either before or after and show how the Foley artist made those sounds work. And kids love it. They love it.
And what are the big benefits of doing a live show, would you say?
I know I did not have the pleasure of meeting him, but there was another guest at South by Southwest who in the Austin area, I believe that he's been able to be profitable doing live shows. So if you develop a real relationship with your local community, you can, you know, you can make a small profit doing this, and you can begin to put on bigger and better shows. You know, I look at one of the standards right now as being the Post Meridian Radio Players in Boston. I knew when I started hearing from some of my old friends in college how much they loved those shows. I knew that they were really reaching people in Boston, and they're doing terrific work. So, you know, you become part of the community. You start to develop a real flow between your audience and you. And I think there are a couple of places around the U.S. where that's particularly strong. Boston is definitely one of them, and Portland. And in Portland, one of the, I unfortunately was not able to see this, but I know that members of the Willamette Radio Workshop pull together with a group called Film Music, and they were producing kind of a, what would I call it? Like a transmedia extravaganza with a silent film and new music and audio drama and voiceover. And so audio drama done live, you have a chance of doing something really experimental. And if it doesn't work, you know, you only have to go through the end of your run. And for most of us, that's going to be maybe one night, maybe a couple of nights. You you don't have to necessarily commit to a long period of time. But on the other hand, if you experiment with a podcast and you're doing a serial, you know, you may feel the need to at least finish the show. And you'll be asked, if you don't, you'll be asked, you know, what happened you know, till the end of time if you don't do that. So, you know, most of the work that I've done has been kind of experimental in some way or other. And I look at it and I think, what was I thinking? how did I think I could put on a show with 30 people and six Foley artists? You know, and that's something that if I were to plan it as a film or a video, I would spend months and months doing the planning. But if you're doing it live, look, just give it a go, you know, just go for it. And you can do that.
You mentioned South by Southwest and you were there. That was it a couple of months ago now?
Mm-hmm.
The conventions, you know, it seems to be a really popular thing in the US. Do you Do you believe audio drama has a strong enough presence at all these conventions yet, or is there still a long way to go?
I think it still has a long way to go. You know, conventions are pretty, they tend to be pretty regional, unless it's something really big like Dragon Con or World Con, that is drawing just people from all over the region or all over the world. And so, you know, Dragon Con people come from everywhere. Same with World Con. And I was so excited to hear that World Con was going to be offering audio drama for people to listen to. But it's been something that I've been trying to encourage locally here in fandom in Houston. And, you know, again, you fall into that situation where it's not something easily summarized and you can fall down the rabbit hole. What I think would be beneficial is if we could replicate some of the experiments that have been done with audio drama clinics, as happened at Convergence in the past. I would love to see more of that at the convention level. If audio dramatists were also not just talking about audio drama, but the next time that there's a panel about, let's say about producing a film, that you have somebody who's an expert in sound or voiceover, which is an audio dramatist, or that you have a person talking from the standpoint of, you know, you produced the audio drama about vampires or zombies, or you do an anthology that's, you know, set in space, and, you know, you should be one of these folks that's as likely to speak on a panel. And I think sometimes, you know, the con level, people are going to be drawn to things that they already know a lot about. So in that respect, if we have fan fiction producers talking about, you know, Star Trek and the audio drama that they develop there, that can be beneficial. I'm not sure whether that's happening right now. I can't say, because I'm just trying to keep up with the original audio dramas. That I haven't gotten down to some of the fan fiction audio dramas, though I'm sure that there's some that are very good.
Yeah, I got a row on the survey for having a go at fan fiction, so I'm banned from commenting on that at the moment.
Well, I can say, I remember one of the Parsec Awards. There was a particular show that I thought was just fabulous, and I really wanted it to win, and a fan fiction show won, and I felt good for those people in the audience who were clearly there to support the producer. But I mean, fan fiction already has this built-in audience, and it's tough because we as a field, we don't have that built-in audience. We got to educate them. And I don't know. I mean, there has to be a way of, I mean, Nixon went to China. There has to be a way. So maybe in a year.
So outside of conventions, and this is a big, big question, but are there other ways that, you know, people could get audio drama into the mainstream?
Well, I think the crossover with audiobooks could be better. I think if we approach, again, if we approach people with stories from the standpoint of it being, you know, maybe in a genre that they already like, you know, if somebody produces something that is high quality and exciting and has relevance beyond maybe, you know, a local audience, why not approach Locus, you know, which is a fantastic publishing journal about science fiction and fantasy, you know, maybe they would be interested in talking to you about it. I mean, and I think that, you know, hopefully we're going to see some of those inroads. I have high hopes for maybe some things happening with Audible. I'm not sure how much we're supposed to I think Fred is not embargoed from talking about it as much anymore, but I look at Lock and Key as a potential first step in the right direction when it comes to audio publishing. And I think if more of us could reach out to self-publishers, you know, there is a very large community that is growing. You know, a lot of them have been using Amazon as one of their platforms, and they're writing fiction, and maybe they would be interested in adapting it to audio. I know that, unfortunately, before she passed away, I know that A.C. Crispin, my partner in Soundstages Radio, Sonia James, you know, they talked about adapting some of Anne's work to audio drama. So if we can build some more of those relationships with people in other art forms, that's definitely to our benefit.
Just looking at yourselves at Soundstages, what have you been up to recently, and what are you sort of got in the pipeline at the moment?
Well, we have been really deciding to move away from one network that hopefully was going to reach all kinds of audio drama fans, and we've decided to, I hate the word rebrand.
It's a bit corporate, isn't it?
Yeah, but rebrand and really separate. I mean, one of the things we found really interesting was that whenever we played old-time radio, we had a regular spot where we were playing old-time radio, you know, the witching hour. And we had new people who were tuning in. We could see that. And so we decided to spin off a separate station under the Noir Dame name that is nothing but classic media. So a lot of old-time radio, but we also we started securing the rights to some podcasts, starting with Stu Shostak's show, Stu's Show. And we've been supporting him for several years as he's produced these interviews. And he's also weekly. So 2 hours, you know, talking to all kinds of people about the classic world. What we really want to do, though, is offer something that's going to be for people interested in creating new work. And not just audio drama, but we know that there are a lot of people interested in writing and in creating new films, videos, and we think that there's kind of some crossover. You know, we're looking at something similar to the community we see in the Mary Sue, and we're still building that right now, but we're hoping we will be able to launch by the end of the year. And we have the Martian Room, which is our new channel that is going to retain the original and modern audio drama that most people were tuning in to listen to us. You know, the horror, the science fiction, radio drama revival, and similar shows like that. And, you know, we operate a very small corner of the audio drama world in that respect. You know, things have moved a little bit away from streaming, and we know that. But we just wanted to make sure that there was always a home for audio drama that's just audio drama. I mean, I just find it amazing. Maybe not so much that SiriusXM decided to dump book radio. What I heard was that they got offered about $4 million to develop a new rural life station. But I was really amazed that CBC stopped running radio drama. And that, to me, is just, it's just heartbreaking. There's so much good stuff coming out of Canada in that respect. And, you know, we just want to make sure there's always going to be a home for that.
Sibby, thanks so much for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed talking. And where can the listener find you on the old internet?
You can find Soundstages Radio on soundstagesradio.com, and you'll be able to find the individual channels there. But if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Noir Dame, and I'm also available on Facebook as Sibby P. Wieland, so feel free to friend me.
Time to rummage about in the old ADPP mailbag. Let's see what we've got here. Okay, this one is from Ed Champion. To the two affable Scotsmen who chatter sweet somethings in their car and dream of potassium fried chicken about the present and future of radio drama. Hello there. We had a bit of a Twitter volley back in May after I singled out your fine podcast, and I couldn't help but notice your recent susurrations about a fantasy anthology series. As you are probably aware, and at the risk of adopting the odious New York is the centre of the universe model, which I certainly don't subscribe to, it has been widely reported that if you canted the whole of Brooklyn upward by a mere hairline of a degree, you would be besieged by an extraordinary shower of gangling writers flailing their arms over the edge, begging for some shaky shot at the not very big time. Of course, very few of these writers conceive of ears as an audience. As someone who has written quite a bit of fiction and provocative creative non-fiction, and who listens incessantly to old stalwarts like Suspense, Dimension X, and damn near anything burgeoning with zest when not triangulating these keen interests with tips from Radio Drama Revival, I am interested in pushing scripted radio to its imaginative limits. This is a medium that needs to be taken more seriously, even when we're firing spitballs in the service of wit. The upshot is that if you were open to idiosyncratic yanks who rock the boat from time to time, I'd be interested to know your production schedule, your guidelines, and what you are looking for. Do you have a dedicated script editor, a house style, a specific vision or unifying tone for your project? If we had a love connection, I could potentially send something vibrant and imaginative your way. What do you say? If nothing else, I hope this email pings into the happy realm of an appreciative listener memorialising his affinity. Take care, keep up the good work, thanks, and all the best. Ed. So, first off, Ed, thanks very much for that. A dedicated script editor, I would say, yeah, probably me, but we're discussing that at the moment. There's a couple of us all banding together to come up with background and story arcs and stuff. A house style, I would say a little bit of comedy here and there, but mostly fairly serious. A specific vision or unifying tone for your project. We're building it at the moment, I would say, and you can get involved as well. So yeah, thanks for that, Ed. And you'll be interested to know Ed is currently working on a script for Valenhai as we speak. That's our fantasy anthology. And just in case you don't know, Matthew and I have created the bare bones already, and we're inviting people to submit scripts based on a writer's guide which we've started, something we'll continue to work on, possibly with your help. If you're interested, go to valenhai.com and click Get Involved, or if you want more information, just drop us a line at podcast@audiodramaproduction.com. Back to the mailbag, and this one is from Austin Beach. Any relation to Palm Springs? Ha ha. Anyway, sorry. Austin says, "Hello, I just finished listening to Aftermath. Fantastic. I can't wait for your next project. Thanks for all you guys are doing. I'm thinking about signing up on Facebook just so I can join your group. Keep up the fantastic work." Thanks, Austin. And yeah, you should get on Facebook and fritter your spare time away. Not that you're likely to have any spare time, because rumour has it you're also working on your own audio drama. So please keep us posted and we'll be sure to discuss it at some point on the podcast. Austin does raise a good point there about the Facebook group, though, because we're often hanging out there with other like-minded individuals. And you can join us there if you haven't done so already. Just search for Audio Drama Production Podcast. And we've got this communique from Robert Thacker about how he tuned in last week. "This was a fantastic episode. Dan's style of advice is strangely attractive because it's so brutally honest. I may start to binge listen to his podcast as well. Formerly, I saw myself as a novelist, but I got stuck for a while until I started writing audio drama. Now I've grown both as a prose and script writer." So, yeah, thanks for that, Robert. That was in relation, by the way, to last week's episode with Dan Black from A Writer's Life. An excellent podcast. Get your ears around it. And I couldn't agree more with what Robert Thacker said there, because I always wanted to write ever since I was a kid, but I couldn't ever see myself writing entire books. The whole thing just seemed to be an insanely colossal undertaking. But script writing, dialogue, story arcs, yeah, you bet, I can do them. And I'd never call myself an outright writer. Hey, I'm a writer, but you are what you do. So don't feel bad if you're struggling with a book. There's always a way for your writing to come out and be expressed. And why not? Audio drama is a growing art. Anyway, so take heart, would-be wordsmiths. The art of writing can be expressed in many ways. Back to the sack. Here's one from Christian of the Once and Future Nerd. And congrats to him, as well as the folks at Hadron Gospel Hour, yay, for being nominated in the Best Podcast category in this year's Geeky Awards. We're rooting for you guys. Anyway, Christian says, just got done listening to the episode with advice for writers from Dan Black. I think he was a very worthwhile guest to have. I loved his advice about using writer's block as a diagnostic tool. I'm sure there'll be lots of healthy disagreement and discussion about this episode on the Facebook page, which is one of the things I love about that community. So, thanks to you and Dan for fostering that. That said, Dan made one comment that I think could get really pernicious without the proper context. I agree that no one will ever become a great writer who doesn't find time to write, and I agree that it's frustrating to talk to people who think they want to exist as writers without putting in the work to actually write. But it rubbed me the wrong way to say that no one in the English-speaking world has to worry about basic survival. I think it ignores how severe poverty can get in parts of the US. Paying for bare essentials is not a given for everyone, and many people need to work multiple full-time jobs in order to do so. I don't mean to come down too hard, because I'm sure Dan was speaking with imprecision rather than malice, but in the quest to emphasise hard work and dedication, we should be very careful not to cover up the very real material barriers that stop some people from writing. We've all talked a lot about diversity in media. In America, class and wealth are tied closely with race and gender, so those barriers are a big part of this. I don't know what a good solution would be, but more robust arts grants in the US might be a good start. That's all I've got. Thanks for your patience and amazing work as always. And I have to say, I dig it, Christian. I guess Dan's tired of all the would-be writers who are clogging up the writing world by claiming to be perhaps more accomplished than they really are. It was just what I was saying a minute ago. The advent of self-publishing, like on Amazon and other places, means that it's been great for people to get their work out there in a way that they probably would never have been able to do before, relying on publishers to publish stuff. But that also means it's probably dragging down the average standard of work. That's my theory anyway. Feel free to disagree, folks, in a more eloquent way than I've managed, I'm sure. Anyway, and last, but in no way least, this one from Elsie. Apologies to you if you've been asked the following questions far too many times, but here goes. How can I turn stories I've written into radio scripts? I'm 77 and was raised in the great days of radio drama and have had three of my own shows over the years. I am inordinately flat out nuts about radio. But I also write weekly columns and have been doing it successfully for 45 years. No death threats yet, no threats in crayon, and I have received only 4 I hate you letters. I write 52 new ideas a year. The columns are essays and short stories. In fact, the paper takes everything I write. How do I submit these to be looked at by someone in the know, as they used to say, who could tell me if these pieces of writing could be translated into radio dramas? I suppose all essay, short story writers think and hope their words can be made into radio plays, but hey, nothing ventured, etc. So I'm venturing. Is there a way to send a few story ideas to someone who'd tell me if there's hope or no hope? Either way, I can deal. Can you tell me the protocol? I thank you for reading, and I very much look forward to hearing back. Elsie Van Savage. So, thanks for that, Elsie. And I would say after 45 years of writing, you're probably good enough to have anything converted to radio. And if anybody's got any thoughts on that, by all means, comment. Email us or put it in the Facebook group or put it anywhere that it's likely to be seen. In general, I would say if there are any writers that want to work with someone in order to get it made into something that can be made for audio, then surely it can happen. You know, just about anything can be converted from writing into audio, I would say. Let's start a discussion. If you want to use us as a medium, email us or, as I say, get on the Facebook group and say, hey guys, I've got something I've written, it's about this, it's about that. Who would fancy having a go at producing it for me? And ask for actors while you're there. All things are possible in the world of audio drama. And that's about it for now. If you want to get in touch about anything at all, anything we've discussed, anything that's on your mind, whatever you want, The email address again is podcast@audiodramaproduction.com. You'll see our show notes covering today's episode, and we are, of course, on Facebook, as previously mentioned, and also on Twitter and Instagram with very obvious names. Seek and ye shall find. Until next time, keep listening to the skies. You know what I mean. Stay classy, audio drama world.